What does it take to make workshops work? And how can we facilitate collaboration that sticks and leads to results? My name is Miriam Hackness, and with the Workshops Work podcast, I'm on a mission to find the magic ingredients that make workshops work. Today with me on the show is Markus Krau from 10,000 Hours, and we are talking about how to guide groups through difficult conversations as a facilitator as opposed to a consultant. So stay tuned. And by the way, if you don't have pen and paper at hand to take your own notes, why don't you just enjoy the show and then visit workshops.work and download my free one-page summary. Hello, Markus. Welcome to the show.
Lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking the time. And I'm excited to explore all the different topics today. And I usually start to kick off the conversation with the question, when did you start calling yourself a facilitator? And actually, do you call yourself a facilitator?
Yeah, well, it's funny. I've used that term on and off through a period of time, which I suppose it's May of 1997. So that will be 23 years, effectively kind of now, when I first stood up in front of a group of people and, you know, was getting paid to do that job. What was then known as a consultant. The word they used at the firm was consultant. I think it was a bit of a too general a term, but, you know, we trained workshops. So corporate facilitator, I suppose, started to get used as a term for a little period there. The word was corporate coach, which never sat well with me. And now I'm entirely comfortable using the F word and saying, you know, facilitation. I'm very, very, very comfortable with that term.
So what does it mean for you to be a facilitator, especially in contrast to a coach or a consultant?
The group is the unit of analysis for a facilitator, whereas a coach will, and again, these are just obviously, you know, woolly categories that we all have to construct for ourselves to organize things. But when I think of coach, I do think of individual as well. They're a team coach and an individual coach. And I think for the sake of facilitation and giving it a territory to sit in, I like to think about it as going, it's about the group. It's about group dynamics and the life of groups and everything that groups can do together.
Yeah. If you were a hashtag, what would you give yourself?
I struggled with this question hashtag thoughtful candor. And the two parts to that is I like to do facilitation work where you can direct attention to things that maybe the group is trying to avoid or working to not locate their energies. And is there to check to make sure we're not being reckless and abrasive for its own sake or overly interventionist. I think, you know, a bit like they say, surgeons like to cut. I think facilitators like to speak. And I think one of the tricks, if it's a trick, or maybe it's the better word, would be to say one of the elements of sophistication is, you know, putting away the scalpel, as it were, for a facilitator, which is to actually when, you know, you have nine different things you thought you might say. So that's the thoughtful part.
And that's maybe also the difference between the consultant and the facilitator, that the consultant is there to speak and the facilitator is there to listen.
Yeah, I think consultants have an impression on them. They're hired to come in and, you know, fix something. I think a consultant wants the group to leave feeling impressed with the consultant. I think the facilitator wants the group to leave feeling impressed with the group.
With themselves.
You know, maybe a consultant displays prowess, but a facilitator deploys prowess.
So how do you help the group to really experience this moving forward and benefiting from the group dynamics, from the collective intelligence? What is your magic trick?
well, if it was magic, it would work all the time. I wish it were more. But it's to spend a little bit of time calling the group's attention to the present. If you think about the management discourse, you know, the popular narrative in, let's call it the dominant discourse. And by dominant, I mean, you know, pick up most bookshelves in most bookstores, you will find a story of prediction and control. The idea that, you know, this character in an organization can somehow stand somewhere that's outside the thing that they're part of, which is the first fantasy. Somehow they can get out of the thing that they're in and they can look back at it. And then when they look back at it, they can render a sort of a beautiful diagnosis. Well, here's the situation. Here's the problem. And then they're able to come up with a magnificent future and they can design a beautiful future state. And then the third part of the fantasy is to say, and then we will flawlessly execute, you know, this kind of thing. And when they're doing that, you'll notice what the time periods that management loves is the past and the future. So we're very good at looking at what did happen and we're very good at talking about what's going to happen. And if you play with that for a little bit, you sort of realize it's quite wonderful. It's quite clever because they actually don't have to do anything. Because if you just talk about the past, well, there it is, it's done. And talking about the future leaves it in the abstract. So you're left with this lovely thing to say, we can occupy ourselves with discussion about the past and the future. But the minute you say to them, I'd like you to talk about what's actually happening here and now. I'd like you to talk about the crossed arms that that Amy is displaying or something about, you know, Jeff keeps sitting back on his chair every time Richard speaks. And that feels, you know, that's dangerous, that's risky. And so, again, that's why we've got to be thoughtful and careful about these things. But I want to bring the group's attention to itself. And to do that in the present moment is useful. And sometimes I'll do it just by saying, hey, did you notice what we just did in those last 10 minutes or 5 minutes?
And this makes me wonder, do you think that this facilitation or this role that you just described, is it something that managers actually need to learn so that they can facilitate the process? Or do they in fact need this outside person to reflect what's really going on in the present in the room?
Look, not to give you to avoid the difficulty of your question by saying, I think both those things are true. Let me go to the first part. I think facilitation as a skill for managers is where presentation skills was 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you go back and you go, why do you go to a training course at work? And really the first thing that took us to training courses at work was computers. That was really the first time adults went back to school. You know, really think about it. You graduated, you had your degree, you went to work, and that was it. And then, you know, PCs came along and suddenly the workplace said, we'd like you to learn something you didn't know before you got here. So go and learn, you know, how to type, go to learn how to word process and spreadsheet. And then you might say, well, what was the next thing that started to happen? And of course there was all the team building movement of the, you know, the T groups and the encounter movement in the sort of 60s and 70s. But if you think about skills that got taught, the idea that you got taught to do your presentation, that's quite a new idea in, you know, the idea that it was a thing to practice. And it's quite commonplace these days, of course. I think facilitation skills is at the same place now as presentation skills was then, which is an emerging idea that says, as a manager or leader, you need to know how to wrestle groups and work with groups. And if you look at all this agile and stand-up and all hands and, you know, whiteboards and human-centered design and activity-based working and all these lovely, energetic, group-based working processes, well, facilitation is just sort of baked into them. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't a time when you go, we need a third party to come in, because maybe there's a ability they have that we don't have. They're just more sophisticated at the craft.
Yeah.
And maybe we go, look, this is a delicate territory to explore and the people in the conversation are in the issue. So we'd like to invite the third party to at least give us some semblance of you're never really impartial, are we? At least move from the day-to-day of the issue that they face.
Yeah, and especially in these meetings when everyone is involved and has stakes, then it makes sense to have the external view to guide through the process. And Bibi, for getting deeper into that conversation, I would like to ask to come back to the facilitation, to link it to the name of your company. So your company is called 10,000 Hours.
Yes.
Do we need 10,000 hours to learn facilitation skills?
So I know this one is a topical debate. So in Anders Ericsson's work that Malcolm Gladwell sort of popularized, but didn't do the work, he just wrote about the work. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea, it wasn't the number. I think people, the number's elegant because it's a lovely symmetrical, you know, big fat round number. But the important point in the work was that it was what happened during those hours, which was the deliberate practice, which was to, you know, work on the edge of your competence. So go to what you can do and then push out a little further and get some feedback and correct yourself and do repetitions. And it's effortful and it's arduous and it's typically not fun. So if you think about that, you know, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's concept of flow, deliberate practice is just a bit further out from that. Mm-hmm. So you're not swept up and absorbed. You're irritated, you're frustrated, you're witnessing your own inability. But, you know, if you're dogged enough, you stay there during that discomfort to develop. So, you know, how does a facilitator do that, right? So, and I think, you know, psychotherapy is probably, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ahead of our field. And they've been working on the idea of deliberate practice for psychotherapists to go, how do you get better? So when you do your supervision, should you be watching a video of yourself from a recent client engagement and then having the group watch that with you and critique it and comment, and then having you role play other alternates and do some repetitions. And so, you know, maybe being a great facilitator does take a number of years. I know I see a lot of differences in my own practice now in year number 23, then there's no way I was thinking like this, you know, 10 years ago. Like, I mean, no, I just look back and go, wow, I didn't know a lot of things that I've come to appreciate with time and with, you know, just more and more exposure to more and more groups.
Yeah. What would you have wished to know before?
The importance of appreciating the local context of the group with whom you're working. I think as I got going and, you know, it was, well, because I started in training, as all good trainers, you start in your content. So you're learning content of what you're teaching and, you know, facilitators let go of content as they move into that style of work. But I don't think I appreciated the value of really, really understanding the particular nuanced context of the group. And that's, you know, the personalities in the group, the context that the business is in right now and the pressures that are around them. And so instead, I suppose I stopped at a fairly coarse-grained local understanding. I'd say, oh, it's a bank. You know, I'd go, okay, I'll think in terms of bank. And you might say, oh, it's a sales team in a bank. Okay, well, you know, that'll tell us enough. Instead of going all the way down to going, you know, this is Alison's team. Alison's been here for 3 years. She's got a very demanding set of goals to achieve. There's a lot of pressure on her. She's got a couple of high performers that don't get along. She's got an IT transformation that's taking people out of her team, which is making it hard for, you know, like I'm giving you a mock example, but to really appreciate all of that local context, I think that makes a big difference.
Mm. Yeah, this makes a lot of sense. So how do you prepare yourself then for these kind of facilitation? Let's say high stakes meetings in this very specific local context.
Yeah, look, there's a couple of things I like to do and you can't always do them. And it depends again on the characters on the side of the client. So obviously we'll have and it depends how it's come about. So sometimes, you know, we'll have a relationship with somebody in the organization who'll say, look, I want you to work with James's team. James doesn't know you, but I know you. And I think you'd be great to work with James's team, for example. So I need you to meet James. And oftentimes, I keep working with the example of James. He has a meeting with us and we call it the two heads meeting. Mm. And we call it that because he's actually just checking to see if we have two heads. The meeting is over in 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. We sit down and we have a quick conversation. And often, these days, and I don't know, it depends on my mood on the day, but I'll often say, is this the meeting where you're just checking if I've got two heads? And he's like, yeah, it is. I'm just trying to make sure I'm not going to look like an idiot if I put you in front of my team. So that's like a bare minimum of, and that's him curating, right? He hasn't got time to meet the entire marketplace of facilitation. So he takes a curated shortlist and then he just checks that it's going to be fine. But what I would like to do in that situation is, you know, hold him in it a bit and say, you know, tell me how you feel about what we're trying to do next week or, you know, this upcoming session. You know, tell me about the personalities that are in the room and tell me who I might want to speak to. And maybe you want me to speak to them because you want me to know what they think in advance of the session. Mm-hmm. And maybe you want me to speak to them because you want them to feel consulted. And maybe I don't need their content, but he needs to show that he included them in the preparation for the event. So I'll always welcome any of those conversations that I can have. In some instances, I'll sometimes say, hey, can I join your team meeting that's coming up? Can I dial into the call and talk to the team for 15 minutes when you next gather with those individuals? Are there any current corporate slide presentations or you know, market briefings that you want me to read to make sure I've got the lingo or the shorthand or the jargon of what they're doing? So they're all the things that help me feel ready. Well, as ready as you can be, knowing that, you know, you're going to strike a match on the start of the thing and goodness knows what's going to actually start to catch a light from that process.
Yeah. I like that you mentioned the jargon or the lingo and that you try to familiarize yourself with it, because then I can imagine that it helps you to align with the team once you're in the workshop, in the meeting on a totally different level because you speak the same language and you become one of them. And this might avoid also getting lost in translation maybe, although you all speak English, but sometimes it's these small words and the meaning to these words that will make all the differences.
I think so. I mean, jargon is a way to show membership, right? It's a way to show that you belong to a tribe because you are literate with the language that they use. And so I think the highest praise that we as facilitators can get is when people in the group say to us, when did you join our firm? And I'd love it when that happens. You know, they just go, oh, wow, you seem to know our history and you know about our projects and you know the names of our projects and you know that they're 6 months behind and you know that Alison loves skiing and, you know, whatever it might be. I think that's priceless, because that's when they know you did your homework, because they know you can't just make that up. You can't guess that. So they go, all right, I think that says you're taking this pretty seriously. We appreciate that we're significant enough for you to have taken the time to come to understand our particular local idioms and practices.
Yeah, and it basically set the first level of trust that they will then also join the process that you designed for them and trust you to guide them through this difficult conversation or whatever it is they called you for.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I want them to feel, which is genuine. I'm not trying to confect anything. I am genuinely excited to be working with them because the privilege of coming inside their most intimate conversations as a group. You know, when teams invite you in to this intimate space, it's a backstage area for them in their world. And, you know, you get exposed to some of the most precious things they may ever say to each other. And, you know, it's a very privileged position. And I think, you know, I feel very fortunate that, because we get vicarious employment in these organizations for a couple of days. And that's a very special privilege, because for 2 days you're working in an airline and then a day later you're in a bank and then at the end of the week you're at a pharmaceutical company before the following Monday you're out with a software design firm.
Yeah.
You're no one else. Very few people have careers like that. And it's not just like going into those different firms to help them with their office fit out or their, you know, their technology, but it's going in there to say, hey, talk, let me sit with you while you talk about some of the hardest things you're trying to solve. So I want them to know that I recognize that privilege of being in that environment, and it matters to me that I do a really good job and that I convey that through my preparation.
Yeah. On your LinkedIn profile, I read that you consider yourself as the guy who stands in front of the room. And when I listen to your words, I always try to think, okay, are you in front of the room or are you part of the group kind of sitting with them in a circle? So I would be curious, what is for you the difference? What does it mean for you to stand in front of the room? And what would be the contrast being with the group sitting, for instance, in a circle?
Yeah, I think the challenge with LinkedIn is to go, look, that's like a billboard or an advertisement. And I suppose I'm trying to use a language that the marketplace will understand more than my collegiate community, such as would be listening to this podcast. So did you get someone to come in at the front of the room? You know, they're thinking third party facilitator. They go, yeah, that guy who comes in and up the front there. Obviously, you're quite right because, you know, we're at the front of the room, you know, because that's where the laptop is with the slides and the Bluetooth speaker and the packet of marker pens and the jug of water. But as you say, we then set up a circle of chairs in most normal buildings. We start in a circle. So I would the LinkedIn reference is more to convey an idea to a in a marketing sense rather than in a professional practice sense.
Okay. Because I think especially when it comes to difficult conversations, I can see that the presence of the facilitator, the physical presence, assuming that we are on site and not online, can actually make a difference whether you're standing in front and guiding the group or whether you're physically part of the group by, for instance, joining the circle. So maybe you have different situations in mind where one versus the other would make more sense.
There's a variable, right? So the variable of where do you locate yourself relative to the group in the room? Mm-hmm. So I think that's a facilitated variable that's quite rich. So, you know, there's no question if I want to, I'll give you an example going the other way. I might be sitting in the group, in the circle with the group, and we're working through things. But obviously you have to be mindful of the practical logistics of the day and that, you know, a third of the group need to leave at 4 o'clock because they have to get to the airport to catch flights. Again, let's hope that happens again at some point. And, you know, I have to be mindful that at 3:45 in the afternoon, I'm going to need to make some things happen. So I might come to my feet and I might move my chair out of the circle and I might go to the flip chart or you know, start to direct some action potentially. So, and at other times I'll sit on the side of the circle. I'll try not to sit. Sometimes I end up sitting at the top of the circle because that's the group has left that space for me. But I like to experiment sometimes with if we're just coming back from a break into the next thing in the group discussion, well, I'll put myself at an odd spot around the back edge of the circle, so to speak, and just, again, let the group play with that. So I think where we put ourselves in the room is the thing. It's worth thinking carefully about that.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Andrew. I'm a facilitator and head of customer success at Session Lab, the dynamic workshop planner tool. More than 30,000 facilitators, trainers, and coaches use our workshop planner tool and save time and effort in the design process. So, how do they do it? Our drag-and-drop agenda builder makes it easy to transform your ideas into high-quality workshops, and the timing of your agenda automatically updates when you make changes. You can collaborate in real time with your colleagues and easily share professional-looking printouts with your clients. And if you need inspiration, you can check out our library of more than 500 activities and exercises and simply drag the ones you need right into your workshop agenda. So check out Session Lab to save time and effort in your workshop design process. And now get your first 2 months of Session Lab Pro absolutely free at sessionlab.com/workshopswork.
And I would like to come back to the high stakes meetings, because the way how you described how you prepare for a group and that you learn their lingo and you really familiarize yourself with the culture of the organization, it sounds like a happy meeting. And then you do the workshop and you guide the group and everything is beautiful. In most of the cases, actually, they hire an external facilitator because it's either at high risk or there's something at stake. So how do you deal with conflicts in a room? So you are familiarized with it. You know about maybe differences in hierarchies or issues due to big personalities. How would you confront the group with it?
Well, yeah, look, again, it's going to be difficult to give a sort of a single sweeping strategic answer. You know, when that happens, do this. You know, we're all trying to stay alive in our process. Right? So what I find seems to work is to spend a little bit of time talking about depathologizing conflict. And what I mean by that is being able to conflict and survive, and just talking about that in the abstract rather than focusing on a particular conflict the group has, although we all know what those things are on any given day, but to talk about the idea that conflict is generative and that being in an unpleasant process isn't a reason not to do it. So, you know, if you like, we want to acknowledge up front, we're going to dislike this and do it anyway. And just to recognize the fact that as we go along here, you know, we're going to hit some bumpy spots. It's going to be tough on a few of us in the room because we're discussing cutting back our spend and it's not going to be a symmetrical exercise. We're not going to ask everybody to take out 10% because we can't bear the difficult discussion of actually what we need to do is, you know, one of you needs to take out 30%. One of you needs to take out 25%. And actually, Annabelle over there, she actually needs to expand by 15% because we need to invest further. So that might be the conflict. So we've got to talk about it in the abstract, talk about it safely before we then get into something particular to the group. You can even practice. Sometimes I'll say, let's have a practice. Give me an issue you've thought about, but that's a low stakes issue, but there's been conflict. And these often gets the group laughing because we might say, yes, well, we can never agree on where to have the Christmas party, for example, right? So we pick something deliberately low stakes, but they do have different opinions on it. And then I'll just put a clock on the floor, a bit like even the clock you have on your website, right? And say, all right, let's spend 10 minutes discussing the venue for the Christmas party. Should it be a harbour cruise? Or should we do a picnic on the beach? Assuming anyone knows a Christmas party this year, but let's say. And then the group then wrestles in and they play around and we're just practicing arguing, I suppose. And so some groups need that more than others if they don't know how to conflict safely. But then we'll go then to the more contentious work.
So what does it mean to conflict safely?
Well, you've got two things at play, right? There's safety and then there's challenge. So if we're going to learn, we have to feel safe enough to take the risks that the learning's asking us to take. You know, so put that into the sense of anything, say a gross motor skill like water skiing or riding a bike, something that takes physical coordination and, you know, typically none of us do it straight away first time. We take a bit to get there. We have to feel safe enough that we can expose ourselves to the risk of falling off the bike or, you know, falling in the water. And part of, you know, if it's water skiing, well, we know that the boat's going to turn around and come back and get us. And we're wearing a vest, which will keep us floating. And hopefully we're confident that the water is, you know, not full of threatening things. So then come back to a facilitation. We have to spend a bit of time working out safety. And then we have to figure challenge we're going to try and take on. But I don't want to present in this conversation here, the idea that this is foolproof. You know, there's always risk. There's always danger. And I think it's helpful to talk about that instead of pretending that our technique can do away with the danger of these. You know, like my parents says, you know, thinking is dangerous. That's what we don't like doing it. It can upset everything if we actually stop and think about things. So we'll often talk about going, we're going to do some dangerous work here. We're going to think about how we do what we do.
So how do you then bridge the gap between this low risk conflict scenario, for instance, the location of the Christmas party, to then bridge it to the higher risk? Would this mean that the group dynamic in dealing with the conflict follows a similar pattern, whether it's relevant or irrelevant?
Tell me more about the question, relevant
so pattern. When I imagine having a conversation about conflict around the Christmas party location, then maybe the patterns that the group takes in discussing this conflict are the same, whether it's the Christmas party or the bonus scheme, for instance.
Okay. Yeah, good one. Yeah.
So is this your underlying assumption that the patterns are similar and then you can bridge from the low stake to the high stake? Or what would be your strategy to then move towards the more difficult conversation?
I see. No, the underlying assumption isn't one of a replicable pattern. The underlying assumption takes from the skill acquisition literature in deliberate practice, which says your third one is going to be better than your first one. Your fifth one is going to be better than your third one. And your eighth one is going to be better than your fifth one. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a bit like Annie Lamont, I think, who wrote about how to write. And she said, shitty first drafts, just write your shitty first draft and throw it away so you can start writing the book you meant to write. And we'll use that with the group because we'll say, look, you know, don't confuse, and pardon my language, but don't confuse this is shit with we are shit at it.
Mm.
We need to separate the merit of the approach with your competence with the approach. Much like falling off a bike and then saying bikes are shit. You go, no, they're not. You know, you're just not competent on the bike yet.
Yeah.
So now you can avoid bikes for your whole life if you want to, or you can say, let me have another go. I might start to see the benefit. So the theory is not there's a pattern, because once you cross from Christmas party to the bonus scheme, well, the room's electric, right? Because suddenly, you know, there's the individual in the room who's responsible, who's delivering 70% of the financial performance in the group, but is being asked to share in, you know, 1/7 of it. Mm-hmm. And so is rightly aggrieved. And depending on their level of, say, trait agreeableness in a factor five, big five logic, will depend how quickly they will state the central issue into the room. So sometimes the room just erupts straight away because, let's call him Greg. Greg says, well, it's pretty simple. I might be 1/7 of the team, but I'm 70% of our success. And I don't think it's fair that I only get 1/7 of the spoils, you know.
Mm-hmm. Boom.
And sometimes that doesn't happen. But what we can say is that the arguments, we will get better at the arguments the more of them we have through time.
Mm. Now I understand the name of your company again. So it's basically, it's a deliberate practice of going through conflict work, whereas it's high stake or low stake, but this will get the group into the routine of going through a conflict.
Mm. Yeah, less about the tricky technique and more about practicing almost any of the techniques. You know, it's a bit like stop watching YouTube TED Talks on running and run, right? You know, we'll distract ourselves with the search for more insight and more technique when really we just need to put our shoes on and go out the door if we want to be better runners. And, you know, in the same way, we'll say to the group, you want to be a better group, just do more work practicing being a group. And, you know, we're a necessary holding environment sometimes in those early days to give them the necessary support, which translates to the safety, so they can take on the challenge of arguing together and being able to do it in a way that doesn't destroy things. Now, again, a little asterisk there that says you never quite know. There's always risk.
Yeah. So what can we learn from the conversation about the Christmas party location, about the conversation about allocation of bonuses?
Extreme, the examples we've got here. But so you might say, we learn turn-taking, conflictual turn-taking. So we might entertain, you know, counter points of view and recognize that we'll do that for a period of time. We learn that time will pass. So we'll put a boundary of time down to say, let's discuss the Christmas party and let's do it for 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then I'll literally put the clock on the phone and lay it in the floor in the middle. And they can see it. And that's quite an interesting holding solution because it shows people that time is ticking and this will end. So even though it might be unpleasant, I definitely know it's going to end and I can see that it's heading towards the end because the time's ticking down. And so we've learnt that we can listen, we've learnt we can take turns, we've learnt we can entertain different points of view. We've learnt that humour might pop up and that might be useful at times. And we've also got to watch that humour isn't a way of avoiding the hard conversation. A lot of teams are quite good at humour and they use it as an avoidance strategy. But nonetheless, that's our job again to keep an eye on that. And so then when we, if you like, put more weight on the barbell, I keep using different metaphors, and we say to the group, all right, now let's go to bonus scheme. So this is heavier now. This is harder stuff to talk about. But in the spirit of how we just went before, let's have a go. So let's hear some different ways of thinking about it. Before we start to debate any of them, let's just hear what the different stances might be.
Mm. For example. So you clearly define the rules of the game beforehand. From what I heard is, okay, so we did basically the rehearsal and now let's define the rules. First, we listen to everyone. We hear what are the different stances or the different opinions. To then go deep and discuss it.
Yeah, I want to be clear. I want to make sure I haven't overstated the control there. So this isn't a talking stick or someone's got push or it's none of that. It's let's go. Let's see if we can. So I might reference what we did in the Christmas party purely because we did it, not that we should have done it. So if it turns out we heard a number of ideas on Christmas party venues, I might remind them of that and said, look, one of the things we just did in the last 10 minutes was we listened to four different types of ways of hosting the Christmas party. I wonder if that'll happen here today when we go to bonus scheme. Anyway, let's see. I'll put the clock back down. Let's go for another 10 minutes. And the other thing about the 10 minutes is you get to have a break. You know, you can say, all right, let's have a go now. Then we might have a break, go and have a coffee break or lunch break. And I'm deliberate in that thinking, I know they will informally continue to work through the issue over the break. And then let's come back and have a second run at it. Or we might say, let's come back later this afternoon. When we come back, let's do something different. And then we'll come back to bonus scheme. Because I'm also mindful of the group's capacity to realize they're getting stronger through the dialogue and the process over the course of the 2 days, for example. So sometimes you can leave this sticky issue until tomorrow and, you know, they're quite a different group in 16 hours' time.
Yeah. Yeah, makes sense. Thank you for guiding me through that. I think it's a very interesting way to approach it. According to you, what makes workshops fail?
Well, again, frustrating answers I'm giving you. I don't think there's a single thing. I think there's a number
of things.
I'm glad
that there's not a single question. Otherwise, I would only ask it once and then it's the end of the podcast.
Yeah, that's right. Look, there's a couple of things I think. The wrong people in the room, that's one that I've seen bring it down. So the wrong people can be, funny enough, most of the time I've seen this become an issue, it's that we've included too many people. And not just too many in number, but too many in terms of where we decide, oh, we better have them. Oh, if we've got them, we're going to need to have them. And we can't really have them without having them. And it's, I mean, I guess it's like a wedding or something, you know, once you start to invite a cousin or you've got to have all the cousins and this kind of thing. So when it's the wrong people, it's often not that there are people missing. It's that there are people present that are frustrating the group's ability, I suppose. I've seen that happen, the wrong people, which is interesting, the whole inclusion thing that gets talked about at the moment, which I think is interesting because it makes no mention of exclusion, but it's impossible to discuss inclusion without simultaneously practicing exclusion? You know, how do you do that?
Absolutely. I totally agree. And also, I think that the over-inclusion of people, especially in workshops or meetings, is usually a sign of avoiding conflict.
Yes.
You don't want to have the conversation. You don't want to be clear and specific enough about the purpose. Because otherwise, if you're clear about the purpose, and I think that's something that Priya Parker writes in her book, The Art of Gathering, in a brilliant way. If you're very clear on the purpose, then you must be, or by definition, you will be clear on who needs to be in the room then, who's the participant. So if you start over-inviting, this means that you don't want to tell anyone that they actually don't belong. So you're avoiding conflict. So you're not clear on the purpose. And then this may put the entire gathering at risk.
Yeah, I sorry to cut you off there. I think it's weaponized inclusion. Mm-hmm. So people are using it as a way to say, well, you have to include. You know, and it's just where you draw, you have to draw a line. So that can be a thing that brings workshops down. I think, you can have incompetent facilitation, and I'm remembering myself from, well, a long time ago, thankfully, but I just didn't appreciate, I was trying to get the group to do something that we'd agreed in a planning process before the session, and I should have abandoned it, and I didn't, because the sponsor at the time in the planning process was very keen on the process. No, we must do this. And I thought I was meeting her need by, you know, persisting with something that the group clearly wasn't engaged in. I was losing rapport with the group by insisting on, you know, making it happen. And so incompetent facilitation, I think, can be quite damaging, unless it's really incompetent. I have seen one instance where, thankfully, this is not my story of me, but I arrived on three of a three-day event and heard from the client. They said, well, we had someone here yesterday who was so bad that it actually was a wonderful team-building exercise because we all came together united in the fact that we hated the facilitator. And we had a lovely dinner that night laughing at how much we thought they were a complete clown and a fool. So I'm not sure what your strategy is, Marcus, but just so you know, that one was what happened yesterday. Good luck. So yes, I think it can do damage, definitely.
How did you build on that? So they confronted you with this information.
Yes.
What did you do with this information?
Well, look, and this might speak to my temperament. I quite like to try to find a couple of risks I can take with the group in service of winning a rapport with them. So, you know, I'll use edgy language. I'll use a story that's close to home for them. It might be a slightly embarrassing event in the firm's history that, we don't really talk about that, but it's kind of funny. For example, that can be useful, like a project that didn't work so well. And so in this instance, I used it. And so one of the things that they had complained about was the 80s dance music that was getting played. And I just asked, I said, by any chance, can you tell me exactly or specifically something that was used? And I just put that music on when they came into the room.
Hilarious.
And they came into the room and there was a giggling and they weren't quite sure if, because they were trying to, so obviously some in the room were going, oh, I know what he's doing. He's trying to do yesterday. And others in the room weren't sure and just started laughing, thinking, oh my God, here we go again. And so I just used that as my opening gambit. So once they all settled down, I then said, you know, I thought I'd just redo yesterday. It seemed to go so well. And they, you know, the group laughs, we talk about it and you know, on from there. So I found it quite useful if you can speak to some of the undiscussed or the unspoken things going on in the group or in the community that you're there with.
Yeah, in a humorous way and related to their reality.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're trying to, I mean, what are we trying to convey? We're trying to say to them, look, we're a good character, we get you, we respect you, we're competent, we're going to try and do something useful together, let's get going, kind of thing. I think, that roughly put, that's what we're sort of trying to set up with them.
Yeah, and there's something that comes to my mind that you mentioned in our pre-conversation, that you loved your profession, but you hated your industry.
Love the craft, yes.
Love the craft, hate the industry. And I think I get a sense now of what you could have meant, but I would love to hear it from you. What is it that makes you so resentful or emotional against the industry?
Well, okay, so I've got to be careful how I answer this. So I absolutely love the craft of facilitation. Our industry, however, is I'm less fan of. So let's contrast it, right? So if we want to call ourselves a profession, like law or medicine or education, then all of those professions, well, they have a sanctioning body. They have a Royal College of Medicine. They have a College of Law. They have an Institute of Pharmacology. There's a body that sits at the top in the middle that is sanctioning access and making sure there is a necessary hurdle cleared in terms of competence, study, application, practice, continuing education, all of those things. We have none of that, right? So facilitation does not have the Royal College of Facilitation or the Institute of Facilitators. Now, I say that, I know there is an association, the AEF?
Association, yeah. International Association of Facilitators. Yeah,
which I think is, you know, it certainly feels like a worthy effort to kind of generate something. And I know the coaches have got their associations, but, you know, we don't have a body that can like strike you down and strike you off from practice. What does that mean? Well, that means that anyone can play. Now, you might say that's lovely and democratic and open access and isn't that wonderful? But it also means that our clients can hire one of us. Mm-hmm. And be exposed to a very wide range of professional competence. Mm. Whereas when you hire a cardiac surgeon, mm-hmm. you know roughly that there is a minimum threshold there that means they're obviously demonstrated their competence and prowess for a sustained period of time before they're allowed to operate on you or me. Now, how do we know this might be true? Well, when most facilitators walk into a room, you know, we have 30%, say, of our audience who's sitting, you know, skeptical, cross-armed, cross-legged, looking the other way, dreading what's about to happen, lots of bad memories of difficult, of unworthwhile mm-hmm. facilitation experiences. And I don't think that happens for vets. I don't think 30% of dogs see the vet and go, oh, God, not another bloody vet. Or 30% of dentists or 30% of, you know, lawyers. You might say, I don't like hanging out with my lawyer.
Yeah.
But that's a different thing to saying you're useless at your work of being a lawyer.
You feel like wasting your time sitting with a lawyer. Yeah.
Well, this is it, right? So, yeah, now I don't think we'll ever have a Royal College of Facilitation or a sanctioning body because I don't think the stakes are high enough in the scheme of, you know, we're not operating on people or in that sense. But I'd love to think, or I'd like to act like it's true. Mm. So, so we, in our firm, we have professional supervision. We do, you know, case-based reviews. We present papers at various communities of practice to continue to push ourselves forward and you know, take it as seriously as we're asking our clients to. You know, they have a right to say, well, what do you do? How do you keep yourself sharp and maintain your professional standard? If you're asking me to, you know, we'll often say we want you to think like a scholar practitioner. So you're at practice, but you're also paying attention to the literature and you're moving between the scholarship and the practice and the scholarship and the practice to enrich your capability all over. And I think we should be able to give a solid answer of credence. Mm. For them to feel like, okay, I'm in the hands of a proper professional. Because if you ask your doctor, you know, well, what do you do? Well, they turn around and say, well, you know, after 6 years of study and then a further 10 years as a trainee doctor, I've done, you know, and so on and so on. So does that make sense? And that's what I suppose frustrates me a little bit about the industry.
It makes total sense to me. And I have a good food for thought now to process what it would mean to have. I wonder whether it's also the part of research, that facilitation is something so complex. I think it's in the intersection between communication, between social and organizational psychology. So there's so many aspects that come into that. And it's not just sitting in a circle and having funny discussions, but it's a very fine line between, I think it's a hard skill, facilitating.
When you say hard skill, talk more about that.
That I see as a craft. So it's not just about the intuition. I think there's the soft part, which is intuition, which is listening to the room, which is having the empathy for the group. But it's also a very clear craft of how to design a process, how to help the group to really open up and to face these difficult conversations. So, I wonder what it would take to have more kind of quality standards in the professional facilitation.
Yeah, I mean, and maybe psychotherapy is probably our best rubric with which to look at this.
Yeah.
To go that field has, worked its way into a fairly sophisticated regime of continuing education and standards and it's an ongoing inquiry, of course, and the deliberate practice movement there is start, mature and try to develop ways of measuring the effect of their process as well as measuring the outcome of their interventions. And I think, for us, that would be a similar opportunity, but it begs the question, who would mobilize and coordinate such an endeavor, right?
Yeah, true. Good food for thought.
Yeah. Well, what would you put in a facilitation school? If you were going to design a bachelor's of facilitation and it's a 3-year program, what do you put? You think about medicine, you go, okay, we're going to do anatomy, we're going to do pharmacology, and the various subjects that come into a medical degree, and they draw a box around and they say, that'll do. That's what a doctor needs to study. Well, the thought experiment of, what would be the equivalent set of subjects that would sit in a bachelor's of facilitation or a master's of facilitation?
Love the question. And I think this would be an entire episode as such.
Yeah, it could be.
So, and I will just give it back to the audience to think about it and hopefully have a nice conversation trigger. And since we're running out of time, if someone fell asleep after minute one of our conversation and just woke up, what would you like them to take away?
I apologize for causing you to fall asleep, which would be my... The privileged position that this work affords us deserves, I would say, demands us to be diligent in our preparation specifically for each event and generally across time with our craft overall. And I think the reward will be the richness of the sessions we run and the results we can hopefully bring to bear from applying ourselves in that way.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for the conversation.
It's a pleasure, Miriam. Thank you for the space to have it, and it's been lovely to share some ideas.
Yes, and I will put the links to your company business page and your LinkedIn profile into the show notes so the audience can continue the conversation and reach out to you.
Thank you for listening and thank you for the talk.
Thank you for staying tuned and listening to the show. I appreciate your attention as I know how busy you are. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and engage by sharing your comments and thoughts, and visit workshops.org to download the one-page summary. I'm looking forward to seeing you back at the next episode, and I wish you a fruitful day.